Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 10th, 2012. We're in Denver, Colorado still, attending the American College of Emergency Physicians meeting, or ASEP. Joining us today on the SGEM is Dr. Chris Carpenter. He's another BEAM faculty member. You may recognize his name because I've mentioned him before. Why? Because he started the best emergency journal club ever at WashU. Chris, why don't you say hello to the SGEM listeners and introduce yourself.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate being here today. It's been a fun week here at ASEP with you. It's always an adventure. I am the evidence-based medicine director at Washington University. And as Ken mentioned, I've run the journal club there for almost a decade.
And that's it? That's all you got? I thought you were like the guru, the Captain Cranium of you know, evidence-based medicine. At least that's how I refer to you as.
I think that's greatly exaggerated.
Let's get on with the title of today's podcast, and that's the ABCD2 score, not as simple as 1, 2, 3. Chris, you brought a case with us today to get us started?
Yeah, we see these cases every day, I think, around the world. How about a 68-year-old female with the blood pressure 165 over 95 on presentation to your ED? She had unilateral weakness. It lasted approximately 20 minutes. It's resolved now in your emergency department. And the question in front of you is, was this a TIA, and how concerned do I need to be about stroke in the next week in this patient?
All right, well, why don't we go back and remind everybody about what the ABCD2 score represents. So A stands for?
Age greater than 60, that's 1 point.
1 point. B stands for?
Blood pressure greater than 140 over 90, that's 2 points.
Is that 2 points or 1 point for blood pressure? I can't remember.
No, it's 1 point.
Tricky. Okay. And then C?
C stands for the clinical features, and those are divided into two strata. Unilateral weakness is 2 points if present, and a language disturbance without weakness is 1 point. All other deficits, 0 points.
And then the D?
D stands for diabetes, first of all, 2 points if present, and duration stratified into greater than 60 minutes, that's 2 points. 10 to 59 minutes, 1 point.
And so the maximum score that you can get, if my, you know, counting is correct, is 8?
Yes, that's fine. Yes, up to 8.
And what we use the score is to predict stroke or badness at 7 days and 90 days, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so everybody's up to speed on ABCD2. All right, why is this important, Chris? Why do we care about TIAs in the emerge?
Well, we see a lot of patients with potential TIAs in the emergency department. 23% of strokes are preceded by a TIA. In the United States, we have up to 500,000 cases of stroke each year. Emergency department patients, in fact, have a higher risk of stroke after a TIA. The latest data shows that it's about 3.1% at 2 days and 5.8% at 7 days.
Wow, what was that again? How many people go into stroke?
In the emergency department population with TIA, 3.1% at 2 days.
Wow.
5.8% at 7 days.
So 1 in 20 people that we see with a TIA of all comers will have a stroke in the next week.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the problem is the TIA doesn't come in with a forehead stamp saying, I'm going to have a stroke.
They don't?
It doesn't even come in with a stamp saying, I'm having a TIA. There are multiple mimics that confuse our diagnosis and make our diagnostic accuracy low. Those mimics might include migraine headaches, occult seizures, transient hypoglycemia, and somatization.
You know, I remember one of the very first cases I had of a stroke mimicker in my first year of practice was somebody who came in and they were hypoglycemic, and boy did I feel like an idiot once we tested their sugar, because I'm scrambling and it's a stroke and stuff like that. And finally, I believe it was a nurse that said, oh, let me just check their sugar here. And duh, of course, it was bottomed out. We gave them an amp of dextrose and boom, back to normal.
But the TPA was already in?
No, this is the pre-TPA era. All right, So this sets us up for what the clinical question is. And in this case, we want to know the specific question that we want to know is, can the ABCD2 score predict who will go on to have a stroke post-TIA, right?
Correct.
And so we do have a paper to go through. And this was by Perry et al. And I'm very happy that this was in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in 2011. And two of the co-authors, you should recognize their name, Dr. Ian Steele, who we've talked about before in previous podcasts on the Ottawa ankle rule and the Ottawa knee rule. Again, I don't like rules because it sort of makes me want to break them, but clinical decision instruments, and Dr. Worcester, who started the BEAM project. And the title of this paper was Prospective Validation of the ABCD2 Score for Patients in the Emergency Department with TIAs. The PICO question for this study is the population that they were looking at was a prospective cohort study of 8 Canadian emergency departments with just over 2,000 patients. They had a 91% follow-up at 7 days. The mean age of the population was 68 years old, with 51% being women. And they found that 34% in this cohort moving forward had a previous TIA. The intervention was that they collected the ABCD2 score, but there was no control. Chris, I had a little trouble going through this with applying the PICO. Could you talk about that a bit?
PICO question is Gordon Guyatt's invention to try to focus your search strategy when you're looking for the evidence. Part of evidence-based medicine is finding the evidence. It really was meant to apply more to therapeutic trials where you have a specific intervention in a control group and a randomized control setting. Diagnostic trials are observational trials for the most part. We're not randomizing patients in most cases to get the diagnostic test or not. And so there usually is not a real well-specified intervention or control group in diagnostic studies. This is a diagnostic study.
So what you're saying, it wasn't so bad that it was a struggle to sort of fit it into that PICO format.
Right.
Well, they did have the outcome, and it was the standard outcome of a stroke at 7 days and 90 days. So, Chris, what were the main results from this study?
So the results were surprising and somewhat disappointing for those of us looking for a standardized way to take care of these TIA patients across various settings. They showed that, contrary to the original derivation and validation trials that have been done in Europe and basically in California and the United States, the ABCD2 rule was not an accurate predictor of stroke risk at either 7 days or 90 days. Specifically, the threshold that the American Heart Association recommends, a score of greater than two, has a 95% sensitivity for stroke at 7 days and a 33% specificity for stroke at 7 days. I will say that if you use a threshold of zero or one for the ABCD2 rule, it is 100% sensitive for that stroke outcome at 7 days, though.
So for the main results, they looked at sensitivity and specificity of the rule.
They did.
Could you give us a one or two sentence of what sensitivity and specificity mean?
Sensitivity, if you think about a two-by-two table, we don't
Yeah.
want to go there, I know, but
No, I know, but
diagnostics deals with two-by-two tables. The truth is always in the heavens, so you put what the patient actually had at the top. On the left is your new diagnostic test, and you look at true positives, those who tested positive who had the disease process. You look at false positives, those who tested positive who do not have the disease. False negatives, those who test negative but actually have the disease. And true negatives, those who tested negative and don't have the disease. That's going across the box like you're reading it from right to left, top to bottom. Sensitivity is the proportion of those who have disease who test positive. Specificity is the proportion of those who don't have disease who test negative.
So true positives and true negatives.
Correct. Not very good ways to think about diagnostic tests. Likelihood ratios are much better. Unfortunately, these authors don't report likelihood ratios, but in our new book, Evidence-Based Diagnostics, we do break down the study's results into likelihood ratios. So for that test of the American Heart Association threshold of greater than two, the likelihood ratio for stroke at 7 days is 0.61. Not very predictive. You would want a negative likelihood ratio of less than 0.1 to help you rule out the diagnosis. You'd want a positive likelihood ratio of greater than 10 to rule in the diagnosis. This is neither.
And the conclusion from the authors were, quote, "This multi-center prospective study involving patients in the emergency department with TIAs found that the ABCD2 score to be inaccurate at any cutoff point as a predictor of imminent stroke." So, you're the EBM expert, you're our beam expert. What's the beam bottom line about this ABCD2 score then, Chris?
Well, unfortunately, the ABCD2 score did not validate in this well-done study. And similar to the San Francisco syncope rule that showed promise as a predictor for fainting patients, predicting which ones need to be admitted and which ones do not, the ABCD2 rule, based on this high-quality study, should not be used in the emergency department to risk stratify TIA patients. Like you said, it's not accurate.
So the bottom line, the take-home message, the thing that you would like the SGEM listeners to remember from this is the ABCD2 score is not accurate predictor of stroke. End.
At a threshold of two.
At a threshold of two.
Do recognize that at a threshold of zero or one, they had 100% sensitivity, and that may be something that you can use to stratify very low-risk patients with a score of zero or one.
So if we go back to the case that you presented on that 68-year-old woman, What are we going to do? We're practicing clinical medicine. What are we going to do with this woman who comes in with TIA?
Her ABCD2 score is 6 points,
But
and
do we
that's
care?
32% sensitive, 87% specific.
Whoa,
I
but do we
can't use
care?
that.
I mean, we just talked about that the score doesn't predict badness. What?
Well, like I said, if her score was 0 or 1, I'm very comfortable sending that patient home. 100% sensitivity is hard to beat.
So what you're saying is that there's no for sure cutoff though for predicting badness, and so everybody will have to look at their own institution and their own practice and decide what they're going to do with this person.
For now, yes.
Okay. Is there hope for us?
Yeah, there is. Some investigators are now looking at modifications of the ABCD2 rule that unfortunately are going to make this much more difficult to use in rural settings. For example, clinicians are looking at something called the ABCD3I and the ABCD2I rules that incorporate brain CT, carotid imaging, and MRI diffusion-weighted imaging results into the decision model.
Chris, I just want to clarify, from a skeptical standpoint, we've got all these other studies. Why should we look at this study as opposed to all the historic studies on this clinical decision instrument?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ken. And the answer is that there are methods to conduct each form of research when we have a focused question. For clinical decision rules, Ian Steele wrote an article in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 1999 outlining a stepwise process for how you develop a clinical decision rule. Ian Steele, of course, is the author of the paper that we're discussing, and so you'd expect him to follow his guidelines.
You would hope he would.
You would hope. You look back at the original studies that developed the ABCD rule that came out of two different rules, the ABCD and the California rule did not follow Ian Steele's methods. In fact, they were registry-based database dives. And basically, they were not actually collecting the data that they reported. They were looking back and reporting it, what was in the medical record.
So a difference between a retrospective chart review and a prospective cohort study in this case.
Right. And Ian Steele recommends that as you get to a higher quality clinical decision aid, clinical decision rule, whatever you want to call it, you put that tool in front of the clinicians and have them collect the data as they would be if they were actually using it in the emergency department. That's what they did in this case. And they found out that when the clinicians collect the data and then you look forward to see what the outcomes of the patients were, it's not nearly as predictive as the retrospective database would indicate.
So that's why this study is a higher form of evidence.
Correct.
Well, just as a final wrap up, I know you guys had a journal club discussion about this a couple of years ago prior to this information, and you were saying this tool was useful. And now, what do you think of that as a critical thinker, as evidence-based medicine person, or as a skeptical thinker? How do we incorporate new information? Because I think that's important.
Evidence-based medicine is a moving target because we've got a continual stream of new information coming our way. So ideas, concepts, opinions change. Our journal club, if people wanted to read more about where this rule came from, you can access it on the TRIP database, Translating Research into Practice. Do a search for ABCD2 TIA or ABCD TIA, and we're going to be the number one hit that you come up with. And it's our archived journal club, a discussion among 100 emergency clinicians who looked carefully at this evidence and then summarized it on a bottom line.
So then, what you're saying, and I'm glad you're talking about this because, I want all the listeners to be skeptical, right? And a sign of a good skeptic is when new information comes, you can change your mind. You can change your mind as new and better information come along. And I think that this paper by Perry et al. About the ABCD2 score is a prime example of how we can have information from a couple of years ago, and then we get better or higher level or just better overall information, and we go, oh, okay, well, now I'm going to think this way. And so we can continue to learn and be lifelong learners. Well, that ends this episode of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. As always, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, give us your feedback. This is the first time I've done this with Chris, and I hope that you enjoyed it. And no matter what, be skeptical of everything you are taught. Even if you were taught it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk to you next time.
Thanks, Ed.